This tape is a production of All Roads Ministry. It is one in a series of tapes which gives the views and insights of Joseph Calley. This particular tape, at the risk of being somewhat pretentious, is Life's Meaning. Speaker is Vin Lewis, founder and president of All Roads Ministry. To start, let me ask some basic questions. What is going on now? Allow me to introduce this work by making a few observations about contemporary events and trends. At first, these things may seem quite removed from religion in any form, and from Catholicism in particular. However, I hope to be able to make a connection and show a relationship. The first thing I wish to mention is in the political area. It is quite fashionable these days to talk about the politics of meaning. This rather trite phrase means that there is something more to life than merely living each day. There has to be something more. At least this is the feeling behind this phrase. Why? The next deals with a form of popular expression. Probably related to this desire for meaning are the phrases expressed by that 20th century form of vox populi graffiti, the bumper sticker. One very common one reads, "Whoever has the most toys when he dies wins." Another tells us, "Life is tough and then you die." I ask again, why? The next deals with the trend among Hollywood types who have, apparently for the first time, discovered that people have diseases. Actually, it is that some people have AIDS. It seems that, as far as they are concerned, no one was ever ill before, and even today, no other disease exists. These unfailingly rich people have also discovered the homeless. They wear red ribbons and talk about the plight of the homeless. Why? The next aspect which I wish to draw attention to is the so-called woman's liberation movement. The advocates of this tell the woman that she is not happy. Instead of being a source of comfort, warmth, support, and happiness to her loved ones, the woman is now told that her only happiness lies in being more aware of her second-class state in life. She is encouraged to be insulted by even innocent male complimentary attention. She is told that serving others is degrading, and selfishness is a virtue. Instead of being silent, she is told to be shrill. Instead of being submissive, she is told to be assertive and demanding. Instead of putting others first, she is told to have her own consciousness raised. All of this is demanded of her so that she may make, quote, something, unquote, of herself, rather than simply being what a man is not and can never be. I ask again, why? The next aspect is also in the political arena. Almost every day, the 12 years of the Reagan-Bush policies, and that's a quote, are criticized by the liberal pundits. In every discussion, this time period is identified as the source of what is wrong with the current situation in America. The key cliche is the enshrinement of greed. Despite the good feelings of most of those years, and despite the fact to a high degree, political and social measurements showed real improvement, the conservative politician is seldom heard who will defend those years or those policies. Why? The pro-life movement has been compared many times to the civil rights movement of the 60s. In one way, the comparison is quite apt. In the civil rights movement, a very large number of the people who marched and gave support were not black. In other words, they were not seeking their own rights, but the rights of others. In the pro-life movement, by definition, every rescuer and every rescue is already born. They point out they are speaking for those who are speechless. Why? The universal answer. In order to answer these questions, or perhaps I should say, in order to answer the one question, why, I believe that it may be necessary to give some background material. Background material may be too vague of a term to describe what I shall bring up. It is more like some basic observations about human nature. The answer to any question which asks, why did you do this thing, is always the same. The answer has to be, because I wanted to do it. To put this in other words, it is because the person wanted to bring about something. This something was something new or different from what already existed. In other words, the current situation was not satisfactory, and the person felt induced by what was going on to change it. To carry this to an obvious conclusion, all the actors described above were dissatisfied with the situation which existed before he or she acted. He was dissatisfied, so he acted, or he chose not to act. Let me go to another issue which I feel is related. Please keep in mind the premise mentioned above. Future views versus traditional views. There are many things new in the 20th century. However, one of the most distinctive things is the career of the futurist. These people make a living, although I do not know who pays them to do so, by predicting the future. There are TV shows with this theme. The theme is that the future is going to be very different than the past. Change is a part of life. However, so it seems, change in the old days was predictable in that the changes were cyclical. The seasons changed, but repeated. The young married, bore children, grew old, and died. Each person changed daily, but the pattern of life was by and large the same for father and son, for mother and daughter. Now the view is quite different. The parent expects that his children's life is going to be different. It will be better in some ways, worse in others. However, it will not be the same. Fathers worked at the same place for an entire life and remained married to the same woman for an entire life. He restricted the social life of his daughter and taught manly virtues to his son. That is the way families used to function, and it is how fathers expected themselves to behave and expected their sons to behave when they, in turn, became fathers. Expectations were based upon traditions, and traditions both formed and were based upon values. I fully realize that this idealistic view of the past may not have been fully realized in every case. It may not have been fully realized in the majority of cases. However, the central point is that it was the expected ideal. It was the standard by which proper behavior was judged. However, now this ideal, while frequently given lip service by almost everyone, is decried as old-fashioned, or out of date, or unrealistic. The point is that this standard has not been attacked and then fault was found with it. It has simply been abandoned as one no longer relevant to human life. It has not been found guilty of some accusation of ineffectiveness. No accusation has been entered. Instead, the standard has been swept aside, ignored, dismissed, as simply being alien to current conditions of life. A comment on rational revolutions. When the American Revolution took place, the argument was that the old system could be justifiably replaced with a new system. as the words of the Declaration of Independence put it, when in the course of human events it becomes necessary for one people to sever the relationship with another. The American Revolution was a distinct break with a traditional standard based upon a self-proclaimed rational justification of that break. Whether it was justified in moral terms or not is not the point. The point is that there was a certain formalized proceeding with events, dates, arguments, and documentation. The same could be said of the French Revolution. The same could be said of the wars of the Middle Ages and those of ancient Rome and Greece. Change was a factor in those days. People knew when change was taking place. However, they sensed that change was something quite different from the ordinary. The natural tendency was to keep things as they were. To change things, some reason was needed, and this reason should be discussed and pronounced as necessary and just. The reason needed to be examined to be justified before men. Change was unnatural and needed to be explained in an unnatural context. Traditional behavior need not be justified. It always appears to be natural. When change is artificial, as a specific rupture with the old, it requires an explanation and justification on rational grounds. The very word rationalize means to justify one's actions which do not conform to a traditionally accepted standard. The conclusion is this. In the old days, before the 20th century, change was considered an odd event. Now change is considered the norm. Some comments on change. The concept of change is threatening to us as humans. It means that what we have learned to do in the past, the skills we have mastered, may not serve us in the future. In a very real sense, it is the equivalent of a man losing his job. What he has done, what he knows, what he is good at, is no longer what is going to be useful to him in doing what is expected of him. Yet change is what the modern person is conditioned to expect. The futurist tells us that we should expect to have several careers, several marriages, to have several sets of best friends, and to expect to have a number of different homes. The Amish, who do not change, have become living tourist attractions. This is simply because being the same as one's parents, living with one's parents, trying to remain the same as one's parents is so odd, so quaint, so rare, as to be the destination of tour buses and the subject of guidebooks. Please keep these two conclusions in mind as I continue. Number one, the fact that people act because they are dissatisfied. And number two, currently change is a universal fact of life. Let me comment about change further. Change is not necessary. Sometimes we tend to see things as they are, and therefore think that this is the way they must be. Change is not a law of nature. Things do not change unless men change them. The human condition does not change. I referred to the Amish before. The fact that they choose to remain the way they are is evidence that despite the society in which one is living, one need not accept its standards and norms. Even today, when the phrases first wife and by a previous marriage are heard on every TV talk show, people remain married until the day one dies. Many people remain married and do not put their parents into nursing homes when they become old. The conclusion is this. Change can come about only if a large enough number of people accept change as a goal and then act to bring it about. Change can only become part of the society when it becomes acceptable it does not, quote, just happen, unquote. Despite the ravings of Marx and his followers, there is no history which is not the direct result of direct, willfully selected actions by individual human beings. No matter how large a crowd, an army, or a mob, it never ceases to be a collection of individuals. Things do not simply happen. People cause things to happen. Thus, the nature of the 20th century, with its constant sense of constant change, exists only because a large enough number of people have come to accept it as, quote, natural, unquote. For our purposes, the more important conclusion is that this means that the majority, or at least the influential majority, do accept and help it along because they are dissatisfied with the present. Or perhaps they are dissatisfied with the very concept of non-change. Let me make a qualification. When I refer to the 20th century, I mean primarily the Western world. Certainly, there are people, perhaps the majority of the people in the world, who live in India, China, Africa, in the same way that they have for the last 20 centuries. I refer to those of us who have electricity, indoor plumbing, access to regular medical care, and mass media, etc., as those in the Western world. Although one could argue that the differences between the modern 20th century man and the men who lived and still live in the old ways are many, I wish to concentrate on only one. The modern man, I refer to you and to me, no longer has to struggle simply to live. We are not merely one or two bad harvests away from salvation. We do not live in constant fear of the plague which may wipe us out in one sweep. We do not go to sleep each night praying to God to be delivered from the fury of the Norsemen or the Huns or the Muslims. We tend, with rational justification, to assume that life will continue until we reach an old age. We will die of, quote, natural causes, unquote. Or perhaps an accident. But we'll not die of an epidemic or at the hands of raiding marauders or because of a drought. Again, to emphasize the point, life is not a struggle simply to remain alive. At least, not anymore. The changed view of life and death. This has changed our view of life, and it has changed our view of death. While death, not only our death, but the deaths of our children, our friends, our parents, etc., was accepted and expected in the old days, now it is considered a great shock. No matter when it comes, we feel as if life has failed us. Couldn't they do anything, we ask? No matter what the reason, we wonder why they who control the 20th century, could not do something to keep us alive a little longer. Death is a failure about which we do not want to talk. Even life insurance must be sold without reference to the word death. A homosexual AIDS activist once commented on the pressing need for a cure. He stated that if one were not produced, and soon, so many millions of men would die within a few years. Then he asked a rhetorical question, and although it was merely rhetorical, he asked it with great passion. Where will we bury all of them? To him, AIDS meant death. Remove AIDS, and everyone will live forever. For he had not realized that everyone alive will die and will need to be buried somewhere anyway. To him, death is a direct result of the cold-hearted selfishness of the Reagan years. If death has become a failure, then life has become a success. Being alive should be enough. For after all, being alive means that one is winning this game. But notice the irony. Because of the advance of progress, simply remaining alive is no longer enough. If one lived in the Middle Ages, when 8 out of 10 children died before reaching the age of 3, then simply reaching the age of 18 made one not only a man, but a successful man, and probably a married man with dead children of his own. Most likely, he felt that if he did not work virtually every day, then his family would go hungry. Simply keeping them from starving would make him a great success. Not for us, not any longer. What difference does it make if the man works or not? No one will starve unless he starves himself. The poorest have electricity, running water, medical care, and pure foods. The struggle for life has been taken from our shoulders. The true starving never suffer from anorexia or bulimia. There is an old truism: nature abhors a vacuum. This applies to the human condition also. What happened to that time and effort which used to go into keeping alive and putting food on the table? It is still in us. God created us with it in us. I need to digress for a moment. Perhaps this is not natural for man. Maybe if Adam had not sinned, we would not be this way. Perhaps we would have no vacuums. I am not offering a theological insight. I am simply pointing out the way things are since the fall of Adam. This is what I mean when I say this is how God created us. I am discussing the post-fall situation. There is in us, to use the fashionable economic terms, an unused capacity in us. There is an energy in us which needs an outlet. This fact of life is this, as St. Augustine put it. We are created to be with God, and we will not cease our restlessness until we rest with Him. There was a sermon once given by a Catholic priest, not an important priest, it was the average kind. But he said something very profound about this. In the old days, he said, when death was but one draught away, we were probably closer to God. We took prayer seriously then. We lit candles simply to be alive and to ask God to keep us alive. Prayer and religion were essentials of life, not merely hobbies or recreations or habits. It is true. As we have become more blessed, we have become less grateful. We are spoiled children of an indulgent father. Given much, we want more and are less grateful and less satisfied. The role of religion. Religion should fill our lives. Instead, it has virtually no place in modern society. I am not the first to tell you this. It is an interesting point which the, quote, population control advocates, unquote, point out, that the best way to control population is to raise the standard of living. The richer a country becomes, the more its birth rate falls. The third world will always have the so-called population problem as long as it is pure, as long as it remains poor. Rich people see each new family member as causing everyone already in the family to have a smaller piece of the family pie. To verify this fact, simply look at TV and Hollywood. Every night, we would see a show in which some rich person is arrested for the murder of a relative. The murderer wanted more. Notice the arguments favoring abortion. The young girl's life will be ruined if the baby is allowed to live. What this always means is that the mother will not be able to go to college and then obtain a high-paying job, which will make her equal to her husband in earning power, so that she can have separate bank accounts, which is a great advantage when the divorce comes, so that she can live well alone in her own house with her own automobile. Now try to imagine one Mexican peasant murdering another so that he could have another tortilla. The poor kill for motives of love, jealousy, hatred, vendetta, revenge. Only the rich will kill for money. Not that murder is ever allowed, but to kill as the poor do, from inherent human desires, is far more understandable and more forgivable than to kill to obtain more artificially valued pieces of paper with pictures of dead presidents engraved upon them. Money. My point is this. In our current society, there is an eager search for meaning in life. To a high degree, money has become a value worth spending one's life in pursuing. Let me combine this with the first two conclusions. One, there is a great deal of dissatisfaction with life today. Two, change is constant and a major part of life. Three, money has become a value. Actually, the third is a result of the first two. Change leads to insecurity, which leads to dissatisfaction, which leads to a desire for what is true, permanent, secure. It is a fact that money does not change. It is the most objective thing in the world. $2 are always precisely twice the value of $1. Money is the embodiment of mathematics. It can be relied upon. It is purely abstract, purely artificial. And perhaps, and this is why it has such seductive power, it is transcendent to man. It has power beyond us, yet we can embrace and employ that power. But more than this, money is a creation of man. Money is, by definition, whatever man says it is. It is a purely human creation. If the people, that is government, say that pieces of paper with pictures of presidents on them are money, and this is precisely what money is. Is it any wonder that men seek to spend their entire lives in pursuit of one thing which can validate in pure cold numbers that they were success? It's not like the old days when merely living to an old age was proof of success. The culture has totally accepted this. Most political campaigns are run on one issue: who can get more money for you? If you hear the media report that most Americans believe that the future will be worse for their children, they mean that they will have less money. This is all it means. Remember the bumper sticker: the one with the most wins. Please turn over to side two. Arm tape, life's meaning. Comments by Joseph Kelly. Side two. Dissatisfaction. Yet remember, also, there is a massive dissatisfaction. The conservative politician will not defend the years of greed, when most people did get richer. The Hollywood types demand that the government take away their millions and give it to AIDS research. The pursuit of money is not the answer. Many marriages can survive tough times when money was scarce. But when he or she becomes very successful, the couple divorces. The value of life. I said that money is not the answer. I did not say what the question was. The question was, is this. Is life worth living? A related question is this. If it is, what makes it so? I offer as an axiom, unnecessary a proof, that this is the key question. I offer it as an axiom that those who have decided that it is not worth living have already committed suicide. So for the rest of us, the question is of importance. Let me add another factor to this formula. The end of life is death. I mean end in both ways. End as a termination and end as a goal. It is a common dramatic device to have a deathbed scene in a play. The dying character may comment on his life, its goals, and its value. And then the living can tell the audience if he succeeded in what he was trying to do. The character needs to achieve this end before his end, otherwise he fails. Only on the deathbed can a person say, "Well, actually, I did this and I failed at that. My life was a success. Thank you." Until that actual moment of death, he can, in theory at least, still try one more time or attempt one more thing. The end of life is death. Whether we like it or not, this is the end of our journey. When we go somewhere, we want to find that, once we arrive, the journey was worth the effort. We want to find out that the time spent was not spent in vain. The ancients tell the story of Solon the lawgiver, who visited Croesus, the rich king. Croesus said, showing Solon his wealth, "What man could be happier or more fortunate than I?" To this Solon replied that no man should be judged happy before his death. Croesus's kingdom fell, and his riches were taken away from him. There is a great deal of wisdom in this. By common consent, the most real things, the most true things, the most valuable things, are those which last. They are the abstract values which endure beyond the lifetime of any particular man. I mean love, justice, honor, courage, mercy, wisdom, all these things. In this, they share a common attribute with money. However, if they endure beyond us, and if they existed before us, then they cannot be of human making. They must come from outside of mankind, from God. In this, these virtues are different from money, for societies have existed without money. Let me go back to two of those conclusions which I arrived at before and which I keep asking you to keep in mind. We are dissatisfied, and we do a lot of things in reaction to this. And we do not have the answer in money. Let me expand the meaning of money for a moment. By this I mean not merely currency and credit. I mean any so-called value which man creates for himself. It could be fame, or drugs, or sex, or college degrees, or power, or possessions. None of these things satisfy. If they did, then those who had them would stop and not look for one more dollar, or one more degree, or one more drug, etc. So let me combine these two in one conclusion. Things are bad, and we men can neither resolve nor solve the problems which we face. Not only that, we are going to die. There is an old Woody Allen joke about the Jewish women in the Catskills Hotel who are eating their meals. One says, "This food is terrible." The other says, "Yes, and the portions are too small." Woody adds that this is his view of life: rotten, disappointing, and over far, far too soon. Original sin. In case you haven't noticed, all of this leads up to a fact which you should already have been aware of. It's called original sin. We all know that something is wrong. We all know that it could be, should be better. We all know that our solutions do not appear to be working. After the fall of Adam, the human condition became flawed. Things, nature itself, are not right. Yet because we were not created for this world, we were created for the Garden of Eden, we feel alienated. We must find something to make our lives worth living, and we need to find it now before we die. Collective movements. This is the reason for the collective movements which so characterize our time. Civil rights, abortion, quote, rights, unquote, women's liberation, all are a cry from the heart. If I work for these, then my life must be worth something. Then I did not waste my life. Then I had meaning. Then it mattered that I lived. These movements are nothing more than money in a different form. They are man-made value systems by which a man may purchase that which he hopes will give him satisfaction. These people want others to read their obituaries and remark favorably upon them. This does not mean that every mass movement, every cause is wrong or evil. Money itself may be used for good. The Bible tells us that the love of money, and not money itself, is the source of all evil. The problem is this. The causes become abstractions and become ends in themselves. Seeing the individual life as being, as a famous philosopher put it, nasty, brutal, and short, the collective becomes important. The end of man becomes to serve the cause of the homeless, or the black, or to liberate the woman, or to save a tree. The individual homeless black woman is never taken into one's home. It is the cause, the abstraction, which matters. This is why it is like money. $1 is exactly like another. There is no more value to any $1 over another. The dollar is a realization of a mathematical abstraction. The cause will live even if the people in it die. This makes it valuable because it is beyond man. It is, quote, perfect, unquote. It is man-made yet abstract. It is money-like. And it is exactly like the trends in psychology. As each new style comes along, the person in therapy, and you frequently hear quotes like this, "My therapist has done me wonders. That's why I have been under his care for over 12 years. Each new trend in therapy goes to the newest method to be, and each person is healed again and again and again. If the AIDS disease had not come along, it would have been necessary for the Hollywood crowd to invent it. It is their Satan. It is their thing to lead crusades against. But they have no God to fight for." Some comments from Belloc. Hilaire Belloc, writing over 5 decades ago, foresaw this perfectly. Lacking a moral or even a rational basis for these causes, those who live for them advance them in a different way. He refers to the current styles of causes and movements as the modern attack. I quote Belloc. "It is characteristic of the advancing wave that it repudiated the human reason. It is fundamentally materialistic. It is materialistic in its readings of history and, above all, in its proposals for social reforms. Such an attitude would seem again to be a contradiction in terms. But the great modern attack is indifferent to self-contradiction. It merely affirms. It advances like an animal, counting on its strength alone. The modern attack is materialistic because in its philosophy, it considers only material causes. It is not troubled by the apparent contradictions within its own body, so long as the general alliance is one for the ending of all that by which we have hitherto lived." Belloc puts this into one sentence. When commenting that the political establishments are now dedicated to the elimination of poverty, they never answer the question, why should poverty be eliminated? If the Lord hears the cry of the poor, if the rich in heaven are like camels passing through needles' eyes, why do we want less poor? The question cannot be answered rationally. Instead, as with abortion and women's rights and children's rights and the rights of trees and dogs and frogs, the position is simply affirmed from a position of animal-like strength. It has captured the style and fashion and values of the modern culture. It has the high ground, the citadel. It infests the positions of authority. It has all the presumptions on its side. To put it in a term which may strike you as an oxymoron, it has the force of instant tradition. Today, when education is spoken of not doing the job or needing reform, one thing is meant. The schools are not preparing students for meaningful jobs. To strip away all the excess jargon, what is meant is this. Schools need to train people so that they can get jobs which will pay them enough to pay taxes, so that they can afford schools which will train people so that they can get jobs which will pay taxes, etc., and so forth. forever. This is the instant tradition. The change is one of degree. More money, more information, etc. The change is not one of nature. The treadmill is mounted, and no one gets off until death, at which time we count his material possessions and read of his degrees and professional accomplishments in his obituary. Then it is decided if he was a success or not. True education. Is this all there is? It was not always this way. In ancient times, and in the Middle Ages, education was given to improve the man, not to make him wealthy, nor to make him a servant of the state. Education made man more of man. It increased his virtues and worth, not his possessions. In those times, everyone, from emperor and king to peasant, lived without indoor plumbing, without penicillin, without electricity. Some more comments on change. Allow me to return to the third conclusion I asked you to keep in mind, that mainly of change. Change is both the cause and the effect of dissatisfaction. It bothers us when things change, because it makes the future more uncertain. When we are bothered with the current situation, we change things. Man was not created for change. Adam had things the way they should have been, but Satan tempted him and made him want change, and things did change. Regardless of how we move about, somewhere in the back of our mind is this return to Eden desire for relaxation and security. This can only happen if the thing we desire is abstract, that is, beyond man's creation, but not beyond his apprehension. It must be truly valuable. It must be unchanging. For if it did change, then it could not be trusted. It might mutate itself into a new form. It must be immune from those styles and fads which teach the fashionable and which cause what is in this year to be not in next year. And it needs to be able to answer questions. If it is not to be, as Belloc put it, against human reason. Thus it, whatever it is, must be satisfying, unchanging, beyond man. It yet must be achievable by man. By this I mean that man must be able to obtain it. If I change, does it make a difference? All of the movements I have mentioned, and all of the actions which I have described in this discussion, exist because man wants his actions to have meaning. And all this means is this: does it matter if I do this or oppose that? Can an act of mind be significant in some abstractly valuable sense? This it, whatever it is, must meet these requirements too. What it is. It certainly is time for me to tell you what this it is. You realize, of course, that I have described, no, perhaps it is better to say I have outlined God, and at the same time I have described Catholicism, the value of death. Catholicism has really only one goal: to reduce it to its most elemental atomic substance. It has only one thing to do, and that is to enable a person to die well. That is to say, die so that he will be considered worthy of heaven and of the eternal satisfaction of that place. It seems so obvious that few ever seem to notice it. If life ends with death, it is only at death that life can be judged as a success or failure. In this case, by achieving salvation or being condemned to damnation. Thus, it is the goal of life to prepare for it, death. To use an analogy, death is the final examination of the course of life. The journey is worth it because the goal is the only place where we can get what we really want. And the only way to get it is to die correctly. Notice the parable of the wedding feast. In order to participate in the wedding feast, it was incumbent upon the guests to prepare for the feast. The journey, in this case, was in a sense being properly dressed. If not properly dressed, we would be thrown out into the dark to weep and gnash our teeth. But there is a difficulty with this, isn't there? If one thinks about this for a moment, then the death test becomes so large that everyday life becomes of no value or useless. If it ultimately comes down to a pass or fail grade in the final test, that is, heaven or hell, then the important thing is to study well enough to pass, and everything else is a waste of time, isn't it? If I keep myself pretty much on the right side of God, then I really do not have to worry, right? So the little things I do, the little sins, the little good acts, they really do not mean anything, do they? As long as I meet the minimum requirement for being among the righteous, everything else is wasted, right? I can do good, these minor goods, if I want, and I can avoid the smaller sins if I want. I can reverse this. I can avoid the smaller goods and commit the smaller evils if I want. Can't I? What difference does it make? I'm still going to make it when I die. This reduces life to a mere waiting for the final examination, which counts. Then, most of life becomes meaningless, and so we have the frenzied mass movements and the lust after material goods. So, the logic tells me, although life in general, the very big massive issue of ultimate big good versus big evil is very important, the small aspects of life are not. As long as I am better than Hitler, I can be far worse than St. Francis, right? So I have a partial solution, but I have a new difficulty. In a real sense, life has meaning. But in just a real sense, living is not meaningful at all. I seldom kill anyone or get a chance to deny Jesus under persecution. I am just going along for the ride. Someone else is driving the bus, so I can sit here, rather bored and somewhat relieved, the actual journey has so few difficulties. It's like driving a road you have driven many times before. You really only need to pay attention when something unusual arises. In case you haven't noticed, what I have just described now is classic Protestant theology. And this is why Protestantism is so unsatisfying. To the Protestant, life is a long wait to die. If this were true, then life could be described as little more than sitting in class waiting for the final examination test papers to be given out. Putting things into perspective. However, this makes life itself, in an overall sense, as having value. But it does not make the individual parts of life of value. Certainly, most of us can easily determine the bigger events, birth, marriages, deaths, accidents, graduation. In the same sense, we can easily accept, at least in theory, the same in the moral religious sphere. But what about the daily life events, the everyday acts of kindness, charity, and assistance? What about the everyday acts of lying, coldness, and selfishness? I am not referring to the major acts, such as turning one's back on a parent who is starving to death. I am referring to the refusal to give the small assistance to a stranger, such as not helping someone with a heavy package, or not giving some money to the common beggar. Do these events carry no value? Do these events have no effect on our final grades? Examine the choices. If the minor events, small sins and small virtues, have no effect, then the value of good and evil, the value of good and the effect of evil have lost meaning. If they have no effect, then it is not good and evil per se, but the size of good and evil. If it leads to life or death, the issue is one of which God will take account after our deaths. But if it merely makes someone more healthy or more ill, then it has no effect, no value. It does not matter. I honestly hold that no human being can hold this to be true. Our natures cry out that life must have meaning in everything we do. Not only is there a logical fallacy here, if the individual petty actions do not matter, how can life itself matter? For we all acknowledge that a whole is equal to the sum of its parts. This is no less true in human life than it is in geometry. What we have arrived at is this. Man must have meaning in his life, which means that there must be both meaning to life in general and to life in its particular moments. And this value must be abstract from God, not created by man, but understandable by a man of goodwill who seeks to understand it. Now, let me point out that what I have described in a very, very roundabout way is nothing more than the universal truths of both salvation and purgatory, the big good and the lesser goods, the grace of God and his will for us, and the value of the indulgences. What the fact of purgatory allows us to do is to see every event in life as reducing some personal evil or getting us closer to God. Everything matters. Not only will we still have the big final exam, but the teacher, in order to see how we are learning, will give us surprise quizzes every day. And of course, as we do better on the quizzes, so we will better prepare ourselves for the final exam. We will not, as I pointed out before, act unless we are dissatisfied. Purgatory, a place of torment, holds out a mental, but no less real because we have not yet experienced it, dissatisfaction, to do good and to avoid evil. It is a great incentive. It tells us that every act is important, and not only to avoid purgatory's pains. It keeps us on the proper course of study. Each act is good and valuable in itself. Each act pushes us towards gaining information and strength for the final exam, which will come as a very large surprise quiz. Notice what the scientist would call the elegance of the solution to the problematic formula of life. The search for meaning and value drives people into confusing and self-contradictory movements. They want abstract values which are not subject to human whim, yet ignore the individualizations of those values because little things do not matter. Life becomes a rat race of seeking material goals, yet the ultimate material values bring no relief, and only vague shame at the very act of seeking them. Unable to justify actions which bring about change, people increase their fanaticism. They both seek and recoil from change. While desiring abstract stability, they work to destroy what exists, as it brings them no satisfaction. Trapped by a human nature which they rebel against, they deny its creator while needing him. We want a constant. We get it in God's one true faith, the unchanging value of Catholicism. We want a meaning to life. We get this in the determination of salvation or damnation. We want every part of our life to have meaning and effect on the total. We get it in purgatory. And it is presented to us in objective standards of improvement, of loss or gain in terms of indulgences. Does life have meaning? The answer is yes, but only with and through Catholicism in order to get to God. Thank you for listening to the discussion. This is the end of it. You can attain additional copies of this tape by contacting All Roads Ministry. It's ARM 55 Palin, that's P as in Paul, A-L-E-N, Road, number 38, Hopewell, That's one word, Junction, abbreviated JCT, New York, 12533. Again, this is Vin Lewis, thanking you for listening. God bless.